or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Evelyn, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 30th issue of the New York Times Magazine on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Your brain is a battleground. As neural implant technology advances, do we need a new set of rights to protect our most intimate data, our minds? By Linda Kintzler. On a recent afternoon in the minimalist headquarters of the MIT Media Lab, the research scientist Natalia Kosmina handed me a pair of thick gray eyeglasses to try on. They looked almost ordinary aside from the three silver strips on their interior, each one outfitted with an array of electrical sensors. She placed a small robotic soccer ball on the table before us and suggested that I do some basic mental calculus. I started running through multiples of 17 in my head. After a few seconds, the soccer ball lit up and spun around. I seemed to have made it move with the sheer force of my mind, though I had not willed it in any sense. My brain activity was connected to a foreign object. "Focus, focus," Kosmina said. The ball swirled round again. "Nice," she said. "You will get better." Kosmina, who is also a visiting research scientist at Google, designed the glasses herself. They are, in fact, a simple brain-computer interface, or BCI, a conduit between mind and machine. As my mind went from 17 to 34 to 51, electroencephalography, EEG, and electrooculography, EOG, sensors, picked up heightened electrical activity in my eyes and brain. The ball had been programmed to light up and rotate whenever my level of neural effort reached a certain threshold. When my attention waned, the soccer ball stood still. For now, the glasses are solely for research purposes. At MIT, Kosmina has used them to help patients with ALS communicate with caregivers, but she said she receives multiple purchase requests a week. So far, she has declined them. She's too aware that they could easily be misused. Neural data can offer unparalleled insight into the workings of the human mind. BCIs are already frighteningly powerful. Using artificial intelligence, scientists have used BCIs to decode imagined speech, constructing words and sentences from neural data to recreate mental images, a process known as brain-to-image decoding, and to trace emotions and energy levels. BCIs have allowed people with locked-in syndrome, who cannot move or speak, to communicate with their families and caregivers and even play video games. Scientists have experimented with using neural data from MRI imaging and EEG signals to detect sexual orientation, political ideology, and deception, to name just a few examples. Advances in optogenetics, a scientific technique that uses light to stimulate or suppress individual genetically modified neurons, could allow scientists to write the brain as well, potentially altering human understanding and behavior. Optogenetic implants are already able to partially restore vision to patients with genetic eye disorders. Lab experiments have shown that the same technique can be used to implant false memories in mammal brains, as well as to silence existing recollections and to recover lost ones. Neuralink, Elon Musk's neural technology company, has so far implanted 12 people with its rechargeable devices. You are your brain, and your experiences are these neurons firing, Musk said at a Neuralink presentation in June. We don't know what consciousness is, but with Neuralink and the progress that the company is making, we'll begin to understand a lot more. Musk's company aims to eventually connect the neural networks inside our brains to artificially intelligent ones on the outside, creating a two-way path between mind and machine. Neuroethicists have criticized the company for ethical violations in animal experiments, for a lack of transparency, and for moving too quickly to introduce the technology to human subjects, allegations the company dismisses. In some sense, we're really extending the fundamental substrate of the brain, a Neuralink engineer said in the presentation. For the first time, we are able to do this in a mass-market product. The neurotechnology industry already generates billions of dollars of revenue annually. It is expected to double or triple in size over the next decade. Today, BCI's range from neural implants to wearable devices like headbands, caps, and glasses that are freely available for purchase online, where they are marketed as tools for meditation, focus, and stress relief. Sam Altman founded his own BCI startup, Merge Labs, this year as part of his effort to bring about the day when humans will merge with machines. Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates are investors in Synchron, a Neuralink competitor. Even if Cosmina's glasses aren't for sale, similar technology is on the market. In 2023, Apple patented an AirPods prototype equipped with similar sensors, which would allow the device to monitor brain activity and other so-called biosignals. Last month, Meta unveiled a pair of new smart glasses and a neural band, which lets users text and surf the web with small gestures alone. Overseas, China is fast-tracking development of the technology for medical and consumer use, and BCIs are among the priorities of its new five-year plan for economic development. While what's coming is AI and neurotechnology integrated with our everyday devices, said Nita Farahany, a professor of law and philosophy at Duke University, who studies emerging technologies. Basically, what we are looking at is brain-to-AI direct interactions. These things are going to be ubiquitous. It could amount to your sense of self being essentially overwritten. To prevent this kind of mind meddling, several nations and states have already passed neural privacy laws. In 2021, Chile amended its constitution to include explicit protections for neural rights. Spain adopted a non-binding list of digital rights that protects individual identity, freedom, and dignity from neurotechnologies. In 2023, European nations signed the Lyon Declaration on Neurotechnology, which prioritizes a rights-oriented approach to the sector. The legislatures of Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina have debated similar measures. California, Colorado, Montana, and Connecticut have each passed laws to protect neural data. The federal government has started taking an interest, too. In September, three senators introduced the Management of Individuals' Neural Data (MIND) Act, which would direct the Federal Trade Commission to examine how neural data should be defined and protected. The Uniform Law Commission, a nonprofit that authors model legislation, has convened lawyers, philosophers, and scientists who are working on developing a standard law on mental privacy that states could choose to adopt. Without regulations governing the collection of neural data and the commercialization of BCIs, there is the real possibility that we might find ourselves becoming even more beholden to our devices and their creators than we all already are. In clinical trials, patients have sometimes been left in the lurch, Some have had to have their BCIs surgically explanted because funding for their trial ran out. And the possibility that therapeutic neurotechnologies could one day be weaponized for political purposes looms heavily over the field. Musk, for example, has expressed a desire to destroy the woke mind virus. As Quinn Slobodian and Ben Tarnoff argue in a forthcoming book, it does not require a great logical leap to suspect that he sees Neuralink as part of a way to do so. The Spanish neurophysiologist Jose Delgado made headlines in 1965 after he used implanted brain electrodes to stop a charging bull in its tracks. He bragged that he could play the minds of monkeys and cats like electronic toys. In a 1970 interview with the New York Times, Delgado prophesied that we would soon be able to alter our own mental functions as a result of genetic and neuroscientific advances. The question is, what sort of humans would we like, ideally, to construct, he asked. The notion that a human being could be constructed had been troubling philosophers, scientists, and writers since at least the late 18th century, when scientists first manipulated electric currents inside animal bodies. The language of electrification quickly seeped out of science and into politics. The historian Samantha Wessner has shown that in France, Jacobin revolutionaries spoke of electrifying people to recruit them to their cause, and writers toyed with the possibility that political sentiment could be electrically controlled. Two centuries later, when Delgado and his colleagues showed that it had become technically possible to use electricity to alter the workings of the animal mind, this too was accompanied by an explosion of political concern about the relation between the citizen and the state. Because the thinking subject is by definition a political subject, the very presence of mind is a political presence, argues Danielle Carr, a historian of neuroscience. The potential to alter the human brain was also understood as a threat to liberal politics itself. In the United States, where the Cold War fueled anxiety about potential brainwashing technologies, Delgado's work was at first approached with wonder, but it soon fell under increasing suspicion. In 1953, the director of the CIA, Alan Dulles, warned that the Soviet government was conducting a form of brain warfare to control minds. In a forthcoming book, Carr traces how the liberal doctrine of universal human rights and freedoms, including the freedom of thought, was positioned as a protective umbrella against communist mind meddling, co-opting pre-existing struggles against psychiatric experimentation. While the United States warned of brain warfare abroad, it also worked to deploy it at home. Dulles authorized the creation of the CIA's clandestine MK-ULTRA program, which for 20 years conducted psychiatric and mind control experiments, often on unwitting and incarcerated subjects, until it was abruptly shut down in 1973. Around this time, the University of California, Los Angeles sought to create a Center for the Study and Reduction of Violence, leading to widespread speculation that the center would screen people in prisons and mental hospitals for indications of aggression and then subject them to brain surgery. An outcry led in part by the Black Panthers shut down funding for the initiative. These developments raised public awareness of neural technologies and contributed to the elevation of laws and rights as a stopgap against their worst uses. We believe that mind control and behavior manipulation are contrary to the ideas laid down in the Bill of Rights and the American Constitution, the Republican lawmaker Stephen Simms argued in a 1974 speech. Over the next decades, the development of neurotechnology drastically slowed. By the 1990s, the end of the Cold War dispelled concerns about communist mind meddling, and the political climate was ripe for reconsideration of the promise and perils of neurotech. In 2013, President Barack Obama created the Brain Research through Advancing Innovative Neurotechnologies Brain Program, which poured hundreds of millions of dollars into neuroscience. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 30th issue of the New York Times Magazine on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As experimentation progressed, so did the medical and therapeutic uses of BCIs. In 2004, Matthew Nagel, a tetraplegic, became the first human to be implanted with a sophisticated BCI for individuals who cannot move or speak, those who are living with degenerative disease or paralysis, for example. Advances in neural implants have been transformative. This year, Bradford Smith, who lives with ALS and was the third person to receive a Neuralink implant, used the AI chatbot Grok to draft his X posts. "Neuralink does not read my deepest thoughts or words I think about," Smith explains in an AI-generated video about his experience. "It just reads how I want to move and moves the cursor where I want." Because he received the implant as part of a clinical trial, Smith's neural data is protected by HIPAA rules governing private health information. But for mass-market consumer devices like EEG headbands and glasses, for example, that can be used to enhance cognition, focus, and productivity rather than simply restore brain functions that have been compromised, there are very few data protections. The conflation of consumer and medical devices and the lack of a consistent definition of neural data itself adds to the confusion about what is at stake, said Lee Hochberg, a neurointensive care physician, neuroscientist, and director of BrainGate Clinical Trials. "It's a good societal conversation to have, to reflect on what we individually believe should remain private." In 2017, driven by a sense of responsibility and terror about the implications of his own research, Raphael Yuste, a neuroscientist at Columbia University, convened scientists, philosophers, engineers, and clinicians to create a set of ethical guidelines for the development of neurotechnologies. One of the group's primary recommendations was that neuro rights protecting individual identity, agency, and privacy, as well as equal access and protection from bias, should be recognized as basic human rights and protected under the law. Yuste worked with the lawyer Jared Genzer to create the Neuro Rights Foundation in 2021. Together, they surveyed 30 consumer neurotech companies and found that all but one had no meaningful limitations on retrieving or selling user neural data. There is consensus that some regulation is necessary, given the risks of companies and governments having unfettered access to neural data, and that existing human rights already offer a small degree of protection. But neuroscientists, philosophers, developers, and patients disagree about what kinds of regulations should be in place and about how neuro rights should be translated into written laws. If we keep inventing new rights, there is a risk that we won't know where one ends and the other begins, said Andrea Lavazza, an ethicist and a philosopher at Pegaso University in Italy, who supports the creation of new rights. The United Nations, UNESCO, and the World Economic Forum have each convened groups to investigate the implications of neurotechnologies on human rights. Dozens of guidance documents on the ethics of the field have been published. One of the fundamental purposes of law, at least in the United States, is to protect the individual from unwarranted interference. If neurotechnologies have the potential to decode or even change patterns of thought and action, advocates believe that law has the distinct capacity to try to restrain its reach into the innermost chambers of the mind. And while freedom of thought, conscience, opinion, expression, and privacy are all recognized as basic human rights in international law, some philosophers and lawyers argue that these fundamental freedoms need to be updated and reinterpreted. If they have any hope of protecting individuals against interference from neural devices because they were conceived when the technology was only a distant dream. Farah Haney, the law and philosophy professor at Duke, argues that we need to recognize a fundamental right to cognitive liberty, which scholars have defined as the right and freedom to control one's own consciousness and electrochemical thought process to protect our minds. For Farah Haney, this kind of liberty is a precondition to any other concept of liberty, in that if the very scaffolding of thought itself is manipulated, undermined, interfered with, then any other way in which you would exercise your liberties is meaningless. Because you are no longer a self-determined human at that point, to call for the recognition of a new fundamental right or even for the enhancement of existing human rights is, at the moment, a countercultural move. Over the past several years, human rights and the international laws designed to protect them have been gravely weakened, while technologies that underlie surveillance capitalism have grown only more widespread. We already live in a world awash with personal data, including sensitive financial and biological information. We leave behind reams of revealing data wherever we go, in both the physical and digital worlds. Our computer cameras are powerful enough to capture our heart rates and make medical diagnosis. Adding neural data on top of this might not constitute such an immense shift, or it might change everything, offering external actors a portal into our most intimate and often unarticulated thoughts and desires. The emergence of BCIs during the mid-20th century was greeted and ultimately torpedoed by Cold War liberalism. Dulles, the CIA director, warned that mind control techniques could thwart the American project of spreading the gospel of freedom. Today, we lack a corresponding language with which to push back against the data economy's expanding reach into our minds. In a world where everything can be reduced to data to be bought and sold, where privacy regulations offer only a modicum of protection, and where both domestic and international law have been weakened, there are few tools to shield our innermost selves from financialization. In this sense, the debate over neurorights is a kind of last-ditch effort to ensure that the hard-won protections of the past century carry over into this one, to try to prevent the freedom of thought, conscience, and opinion, for example, from being effectively suppressed by the increasingly algorithmic experience of everyday life. How much privacy might we, as a society, be willing to trade in exchange for augmented cognition? In 3 years, we will have large-scale models of neural data that companies could put on a device or stream to the cloud to try to make predictions said Mackenzie Mathis, a neuroscientist at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, Lucene, how those kinds of data transfers should be regulated, she said, is an urgent question. We are changing people, just like social media or large language models changed people. Under these conditions, the challenge of ensuring that individuals retain the ability to manage access to their innermost selves, however defined, becomes all the more acute. Our mental life is the core of our self, and we used to be sure that no one could break this barrier, Lavazza said. The collapse of this surety could be an invitation to dread a future in which the unrestricted use of these technologies will have destroyed society as we know it, or it could be an occasion to rethink the politics that got us here in the first place. The writer who stopped time, Solveig Ball, spent 30 years composing a 7-part novel about one day, and it has made her an unlikely literary sensation, by Dennis Zhu. To get to Aero, the island in the Baltic Sea where the Danish writer Solveig Ball lives, I took a plane, 2 trains, a ferry, and a bus. After landing in Copenhagen in the summer of 2024, I took a train to Svendborg, the southernmost town on the island of Funen, and waited to board the ferry. Groups of teenagers sported the caps that distinguish a recent secondary school graduate. I eventually arrived on Aero and made my way to the town where Ball lives. As my bus wended its way across the island, through fields dotted with churning windmills and past red shingled cottages, my sense of time slipped. I missed my stop and disembarked on an empty street past the location where Ball had arranged to pick me up. A few minutes later, a woman in a black dress, a sweatshirt, and sandals came into view, pushing a bicycle with a step-through frame and a basket. As she neared, I glimpsed her red hair tied up in a scrunchie. Ball squinted at me through glasses that seemed of a slightly outdated prescription. "Is it Monday?" she asked, as she grabbed my bag and plopped it into the basket of her bicycle. I'm not really into these things. I couldn't tell if she meant interviews or time itself. Ball took me to her home for lunch, apologizing in advance for the state it was in. "When the book is a mess, my house is a mess," she explained. Excuse me. After Ball deposited her bicycle in the garden, we entered through the side door. Wallpaper was peeling, revealing an underlying herringbone pattern that Ball wanted to restore, and cabinets lay upended across the floor. Works by her ex-husband, Simon Lewis, the British artist, hung next to William Blake's print of Laocoon and his sons, and a drawing by her son, Asmus, of a cheerful, multi-limbed alien. A grand piano held sheet music for the theme song for the 1993 film, The Piano. One bin labeled Things sat next to another labeled And Some Other Things. Ball had just finished the 5th book of her 7-part novel, On the Calculation of Volume. The novel tells the story of Tara Selter, an antiquarian bookseller who wakes up one morning to find she is endlessly reliving the same day, the 18th of November. How, the novel asks, might she regain a future? As Selter explores her everlasting present, she confronts the world's finitude and rediscovers the texture of everyday life. Calculation gestated for more than 30 years before Ball self-published the first volume in 2020 through her own press. Telegraph. The books amassed a cult following in Denmark and became a sensation across Scandinavia. The first 3 volumes won the Nordic Council Literature Prize, previously awarded to the Nobel Prize winner John Fosse in 2022. The storied American publisher New Directions released the first two volumes in a translation by Barbara Haviland in 2024 and will release the third volume, translated by Sophia Hersey-Smith and Jennifer Russell, on November 18th. It has committed to running the entire Septology over a four-year period, an unusual expression of faith in a writer who is still in the process of completing her project. The novel has captivated readers in part by elevating its Groundhog Day-like premise into a philosophical and existential thriller, and garnered the kind of devotion usually reserved for genre fiction. Calculations provides the pleasure of figuring out the rules of an alternate universe that eerily resembles our own. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 30th issue of the New York Times Magazine on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The writer Sloane Crosley, who said she usually did not succumb to the kind of literary fandom associated with Harry Potter readers, told me, "I've just been that person that's sort of genuinely wondering, do I learn Danish so I can read the entire series before they're all translated?" She likened the experience of reading Calculation to that of entering a dollhouse, in which everything seems recognizable but almost imperceptibly off, a feat that could be accomplished only by a writer who knew every crevice of her fictional environment. "It's like she's thought of every scenario," Crosley said, "and when I say that, it's probably because she's been thinking about it for 30 years. The novelist Hernan Diaz described the novel's chief appeal as its ability to distill a sense of isolation common to contemporary life. The first volume came out a few weeks before Denmark went into lockdown during the COVID-19 pandemic. "It has to do with an emotional kind of truth," Diaz explained. "How lonely we are, how stuck we are, how hard it is for all of us to reach across and touch someone. I had expected Baal to be a recluse. To some extent, that's true. She refuses to fly or drive and rarely leaves the island, even after her novel's success. But she is also a thoughtful, impish interlocutor who is very much in the world. During our conversations, Baal often spoke in long tangents, jumping from her research into subjects like aesthetic theory to a discussion of the nature of time, as if she had momentarily lost the plot or was testing her interlocutor's patience. As Baal cubed cantaloupe and mandolined hard-boiled eggs into a Medici salad, I sensed that Baal had simply decided to live her life at a different pace and from a different vantage point, the better to diagnose our unwillingness both to acknowledge existential threats and to appreciate the quotidian pleasures that they might extinguish." Baal was born in a small town on Denmark's Jutland Peninsula in 1962. Her father worked as a special education teacher. Her mother is a nurse. Both parents came from poor families with backgrounds in farming and gardening. They encouraged Baal to read widely but never conceived of writing as a career, which she described to me as somebody else's house, a place she could never fully occupy. Still, when she was 16, Baal completed a series of short stories, mostly inspired by the lives of her classmates. She locked the manuscripts in a drawer and kept the key hidden in her guitar case, but eventually submitted the collection to the publisher Gyldendal, which issued luminaries like Henrik Ibsen and Soren Kierkegaard. They rejected the stories, but encouraged her to keep writing. A friend found the rejection letter in the publisher's archive decades later, after Gyldendal went on to publish Baal. In 1979, when she was 17, Baal traveled to Paris to work as an au pair and eventually lived as one of the tumbleweeds at the legendary bookstore, Shakespeare and Company, where she helped out in exchange for a bed on the shop's second floor. She spent her 20s as an itinerant student, taking classes with the feminist philosopher Julia Kristeva and at the Sorbonne. In 1990, she followed a boyfriend to Cornell in Ithaca, New York, where she took classes in the philosophy of language and logic. That same year, she and the boyfriend went on a road trip through the United States and married on a whim while passing through Las Vegas. All the while, she was writing her first novel, a retelling of Robinson Crusoe, titled Lyrifugi, The Lyrebird, was published in 1986. It told the story of an island populated by women who were all called variations on the word Friday, the name of Crusoe's faithful servant. By 1987, Ball had enrolled in a new writing school in Copenhagen, simply called the Writer's School. There she met Christina Hesselhold, the novelist who would become her close friend and first reader. Together, they taught classes at the school, edited a literary magazine called Den Blå Port, The Blue Door, and were part of a new generation of women writers in Denmark. Whereas previous women had published barrier-breaking confessional work that explored autobiography, Ball's generation gravitated toward more objective or philosophical themes, often in experimental forms that straddled the novel, essay, poetry, and short story. They devised a sharp, minimalist style to convey the urgency of the physical, concrete experiences of women's lives. In the 90s, we were quite interested in not using psychology in our writing, Hesselhold explained to me. We were more interested in phenomenology, and a way to avoid psychology was not to work with characters, but with containers. Using these containers freed them to study women's perspectives on the world rather than the content of their lives. Writers like Ball and Hesselhold asked a simple question: what does the world look like if readers are forced to take feminine experience as a given? Ball remembered studying Hegel and concluding that he had forgotten to think about women. He had to make a whole story about guys going to war in order to encounter death without having to look at people in childbirth, she told me. And I remember sitting in that room and looking at these texts, and I was ready just to put my hand up and say, why doesn't he look to the right instead of to the left? Ball has spent her career reconsidering what kinds of perspectives deserve attention. According to the law, 1993, her second book, was a compilation of four linked stories that took as their premise different natural laws. In one story, a scientist named Nicholas tries to calculate God's height while flying over the Arctic Ocean, using the size of imprints left on the frozen surface of the water that he takes to be God's footprints. It's a farcical idea, but Ball treats it with all the seriousness of physics. After roughly calculating the size of one of those footprints, Nicholas asserts that if it were true that man had been created in God's image, then all they needed in order to calculate God's size was a figure representing the ratio between the size of a person's footprint and their height. Nicholas removes his shoes and socks, and the reader is treated to a closely narrated series of measurements that determines God's height to be 211 kilometers. The story carries Ball's hallmark self-consciously clinical prose, a sharp sense of humor, and a skepticism toward the hubris that drives our pursuit of knowledge. At the same time, it carries a touching conviction that human beings carry within themselves the scales to measure the unfathomable, or at least to try to do so, no matter how foolish or fruitless an enterprise. According to the law, which was translated into more than 10 languages and published in Britain and the United States in 1996, was a success both at home and abroad, and became a fixture of Danish secondary school and university classrooms. But having a public profile became too much for Ball. There was a significant amount of expectation that she would follow up with more conceptually weighty fiction. Instead, her new book, Eller, 1998, was a collection of delicate poetic fragments. Her personal life, meanwhile, became turbulent. In 1996, she and her first husband divorced. The next year, she met Lewis at an artist's residency in Germany, and the year after that, they married. She also finally received her bachelor's degree, having pursued it intermittently for 14 years. The pair returned to Copenhagen together, but left soon afterward. Ball described the decision as primarily financial, given that she and Lewis had begun discussing having a family. In 2002, Ball gave birth to her son, Asmus. 3 years later, her family moved to Arrow. In the literary world, however, Ball's absence felt to some like an abdication. She was the young hope of Danish literature, as one Danish newspaper put it. But then Ball was gone. Ball described her first years on the island as a blur, as she and Lewis balanced renovating their home and raising their child. Before, Ball worked an average of 80 hours a week. Now she ate breakfast on the beach with her family, picked strawberries and made jam, shepherded Asmus to and from daycare. A book about aesthetics came out in 2005, then a memoir in 2008. Both went without much notice, and soon, Ball recalls, Gyldendal began pulping Ball's overstock without informing her. Annoyed, Ball bought back the rights to her work and set up Pellegraph in 2011. As a teenager, Asmus became her business manager. He would drop off copies of his mother's books with booksellers by bicycle. Simultaneously influenced by experiments in time like James Joyce's Ulysses and Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain, Ball was steadily working on what would become Calculation. As early as 1987, she had the concept for a novel in which a single day repeats itself. At one point, she wrote a draft and threw it away. But as the years passed, she found herself unable to relinquish the idea. Ball and Lewis divorced. Asmus grew older, and eventually Ball had the house to herself. Through all the change, she grew accustomed to living alongside her protagonist, Tara Selter, who runs a rare book business with her husband Thomas, from their home in the north of France. When Tara travels to Paris as part of a book-buying trip, she discovers that time has fallen apart. On November 18th, in an unspecified year, she wakes up in her hotel room, eats breakfast in the hotel restaurant, gathers a few tomes on subjects including the history of potable water and celestial bodies, visits a numismatist friend specializing in ancient Roman coins, and talks to Thomas on the phone before falling asleep. The next day, she notices another hotel guest dropping a slice of bread on the floor in an eerily identical manner to the prior day. Newspapers and receipts display the date as the 18th, and not one of her acquaintances, including Thomas, remembers their conversations from the day before. Calculation takes the form of a journal with entries according to the date of Tara's confinement, a year's worth by the end of Volume 1, more than 1,000 by the end of Volume 2. Ball's decades-long grounding in philosophy shapes not only the book's details, but its very framework. A presiding interest in Ball's writing is what the historian of science, Thomas Kuhn, called the paradigm shift, the notion that human knowledge progresses through seismic disruptions that force us to revise our understanding of how reality functions. As Tara documents her investigations with a rigor that approaches the scientific method, her journal entries trace the ways that her new reality is no longer commensurate with the old. Now that she lives across a rift in time from her loved ones, she must rethink everything from how she interacts with her environment to the nature of love and domesticity. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 30th issue of the New York Times Magazine on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. We learn very little of Tara's background, other than a few details about her childhood and marriage. Instead, the novel pays obsessive attention to the logistics of her experience. What happens to possessions in such a world? To garbage, to money, to our sense of self. The things that Tara purchases have a tendency to disappear overnight until she discovers that she can sleep with them under her pillow. The items she consumes from the grocery store do not always reappear on the shelves the next day. Digital records evaporate overnight. In paying attention to these phenomena, Tara becomes aware of the world in a new way. She quickly realizes, for example, that nothing she eats ever returns. It was the who made things disappear, she says. I am living in a time that eats up the world. She resorts to scavenging rather than irreversibly consuming resources. Ball's language is consistent in its clarity and also in the way it toggles among modes within the span of a paragraph. Attentiveness to physical details and scientific processes, an evocation of memory and a sense of wonder in the face of the ordinary. In one scene, Tara and her husband focus on the most mundane of tasks, the frying of an egg. We commented on every detail of what was happening to ensure that we were both focusing on the same thing, Tara recalls. We talked about the surprise of childhood eggs with double yolks, she goes on. There you were in the kitchen with your mother or your grandfather. You cracked an egg, and if it were a particularly large egg, often there would be two yolks in the bowl. Calculation suggests that the potential for collective experience lies in the minutiae of domestic life. The ramifications are slyly political. Some writers, Ball told me, can own the world only because there's something they've forgotten to look at. Unlike her Scandinavian colleagues, Carl Ove Nausgaard and John Fosse, whose own multi-volume novels employed a repetitive obsession with the banal to explore their autobiographies or the intricacies of religious transcendence, Ball turns out toward the world, not away from it, in calculation. Tara's environment is not merely grist for human consciousness. It has its own narrative. Tara is simply a character like any other, no more or less important than the egg she cooks, the skillet she holds, or the pillow she sleeps on. Today, the various editions of Calculation have sold more than 170,000 copies worldwide. The first volume of the English edition was longlisted for a National Book Award and shortlisted for the 2025 International Booker Prize. Volume 3 has been shortlisted for a National Book Award as well. The success of the books has also brought with it more attention, interview requests, fan mail, opportunities to be celebrated than Ball has ever received in her career. She has declined most invitations, including attending a ball with the King and Queen of Denmark. She considered visiting the United States last fall to celebrate the publication of New Directions editions of the first two volumes, but given her aversion to flying, ultimately decided not to go. She's still considering an eventual trip by freighter. In July, she and I spoke via video call, exactly 1 year after we first met. She appeared on camera with slightly damp hair. There had been a downpour in her garden. She seemed happy not to have won the Booker Prize. It was like having been invited to a party but not having to stay and clean the dishes. Though she was grateful for the expanded readership, the recent recognition had been mostly a distraction for her. Her role as a publisher had fallen by the wayside. She had forgotten to reprint her old volumes, which were now sold out and in demand. She had also just finished Volume 6, which would soon appear in Danish with a salmon pink cover, in a run of 3,000 copies without an author photo, blurbs, or biographical information, distinguished from the previous installments only by a Roman numeral and new color. Work had begun on Volume 7, for which she had already amassed hundreds of pages. "The book has actually taken up all the space in my head," Ball said. "I think I still had a little bit of my brain left when you were here, and now it's all gone. Somebody said to me, 'All of New York is talking about this book,'" Ball added incredulously, "but in a way it's so far away that I don't have to worry about it, because everything here is the same." When I asked her what was different between the current round of attention and her previous success in the 90s, she said simply that she is older now than she was then, but it also seemed as if she had built for herself what she did not have before, the kind of refuge that made outside scrutiny irrelevant. I asked her what she would do once the Septology was finally completed. She didn't seem wistful about approaching the project's end, though she did worry that she had set her mind to a puzzle that she wouldn't be able to solve. Still, after decades of living with Tara, the impending separation seemed potentially bittersweet. "I am actually looking forward to being finished, but then when I start thinking about it, I have this feeling I'm going to miss Tara Selter," Ball said. "And what would Tara think about her?" "Oh, I'm sure that she's not going to want me around anymore when she's finished," she asked. She joked, "I think she'll be very happy to get rid of me." You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 30th issue of the New York Times Magazine. Your reader has been Evelyn. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the USA Today. Following that at 2 o'clock is episode number 6 of Boat Baby by Vicky Nguyen. Stay with us for these readings and more through the rest of the day. You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. We broadcast daily readings of printed matter to those who are blind or have a print disability throughout Buffalo, Western New York, and Southern Ontario's Niagara Peninsula. Almost 40 years and more than 300,000 hours of radio readings to those without sight. Our broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service broadcast studios are at 1199 Harlem Road in Cheektowaga. Please let others know about your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. For more information, call us at 716-821-5555.
Hello.